Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
So where do we land on this whole Korean royal family thing?
I thought that there turned out that there was one.
Yeah, I think where we land is that I was right and you were all wrong to be skeptical and I'm amazing. Is that not right?
We seem to get some feedback to the contrary via the interwebs after the last episode, suggesting that there is not a current Korean royal family, at least not involved in the government in the way of a monarchy. Like, maybe there's a royal family, but not a monarchy.
From the Wikipedia page, so apologies to all listeners who actually know anything about this.
to all our Korea specialists.
It appears that after the Japan-Korea Treaty of 1910, in which the Empire of Japan annexed the Korean Peninsula, some members of the Jeonju-Yi clan, so that's the royal dynasty, were incorporated into the Imperial House of Japan. This lasted until 1947. The treaty was nullified. It seems like they are not part of the government, but according to Wikipedia, they, quote, continue to be given preference and constitute a favored symbol in South Korea. I have absolutely no idea what that means.
Oh, that's tricky.
Yeah. That's not. So we weren't that far off then,
no.
Listeners. angry Twitter listeners. I was shocked. Our takes on royal families and monarchies generally generated more negative responses than I have seen to anything else we've said on this show.
Wait, why? Because our listeners are royalists, or because they're Jacobins?
I think they just have very strong feelings about monarchy generally, and
but
generally
like pro
they
or
to be,
anti.
It was very hard to tell because they're British, so they're very reserved. So I think it was a lot of just strong feelings without much clarity about one way or the other.
The stiff upper lips stiffened even more.
Yeah, a pinky rubbed by the teacup gravitated a few inches further away, indicating displeasure, and that was all we got. But in Twitter format, still comes off pretty harsh, it turns out.
That's awesome.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Rational Security 2.0. I am one of your co-hosts, Scott R. Anderson, and I am here with my two other co-hosts, Alan Rosenstein.
Hello.
And Quinta Jurassic.
Hello.
And we are thrilled to be guestless this week, giving us a little bit more time.
Guestless and friendless.
Exactly, exactly. Someday we will have another guest, but not this week.
Our guests are right out of frame.
It means we can take our usually complete lack of concise ability to frame our thoughts and really just abandon the idea entirely and fill the whole hour with our own ideas. And I will take that. For what we are calling this week the Korea Culpa edition, in acknowledgement of some of the confusion about how we may have handled the existence of a royal family in South Korea in our last episode. Although, as hopefully our B-roll covered, I'm not sure as far as some people seem to appear.
We were online. Right.
We are all like 80% right.
I don't know, except me. I feel it wasn't the conclusion that I was wrong, and the rest of it is the rest of you all may have been.
That's where we landed.
Goes without
yeah.
saying, Alan.
Yeah. That's just our default sort of rest. Yeah. That's our we have resting Alan's wrongs. That's just where we are.
That's awesome.
At the general posture of this show.
You know, you and my 18-month-old.
Exactly. Oh, don't get me started. It's been a rough 48 hours of fatherhood lately, but that's okay. Separate story. Regardless, I am thrilled to be here with you two for the Korea Culpa edition, as we have a couple of topics up our respective alleys to talk about that happened this week in terms of big stories in the national security space. Topic one, Namakite Pa. A classic song people may remember from covers from Nina Simone and a few other folks, and most recently Wyclef Jean, of note, of course, the famous Haitian rapper and songwriter, because this topic is about his native country of Haiti, because the nearby island nation of Haiti is hitting new levels of instability as paired economic and political crises have given way to open gang warfare in broad swaths of the country. While these events have some calling for external intervention, others have expressed major reservations with such a step, given its past failings in the country. Where might this crisis lead? Topic two, I'm rubber, you're suing. Last week, the Fifth Circuit released a real barn burner of an opinion. You all would find that funny. I thought that was my least funny one of the three. Well, the first one's not funny.
No, that pun is on the level with Judge Oldham's opinion.
There we go. Ooh, there we go. I unfortunately know what that means. That's okay. As I bothered to read this stupid thing. But regardless, last week, the Fifth Circuit released a real barn burner of an opinion in the matter of NetChoice v. Paxton, wherein it adopted a narrow reading of the First Amendment in order to resurrect a Texas law severely limiting how social media platforms can moderate content. What will this case mean for platforms moving forward? Topic 3, flying worst class. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis has become the latest Republican governor to fly undocumented migrants to northern cities in purported protest of the Biden administration's immigration policies. But his move has sparked unexpected furor among Florida's Cuban and Venezuelan immigrant communities, among others, as well as at least one criminal investigation. What was he thinking, and where will this controversy go next? For our first topic, Alan, let me hand it over to you.
So I was thinking about where to begin in talking about the situation in Haiti, and just going back and doing a little more research just to kind of reacquaint myself with the history of this country. There are a number of places. In the long sweep, Haiti has been really racked with political, economic, and just geophysical instability for decades. Just since 2000, it suffered from a coup, a UN peacekeeping intervention that ended several years ago, a horrible earthquake, an assassination of its political leadership. The latest crisis has come because the government has instituted increases in energy costs, or to be more precise, it has removed some of the subsidies that were keeping energy prices accessible for everyday Haitians. It's a country that is very, very poor, where people are really, really struggling. And this has set off a new round of protests. And protest is actually probably putting it very mildly. At this point, the country has fallen almost into complete anarchy. There is no president. The government is not working. The judiciary isn't working. The country is basically controlled by rival gangs, which are themselves not just gangs, but are in some ways playing the role of government and trying to provide basic services. Violence is increasing, and there's no immediate path out of this situation. While Haiti is not on the front news of American media, it is notable. This is not a faraway country, right? This is a very close neighbor. It's right next to Puerto Rico. It's between Puerto Rico and Cuba, very much an American neighbor. So a lot to talk about here. Scott, I want to ask you the first question, which is, do you think at this point we can say, not as a criticism, just as a descriptive fact, that Haiti is a failed state?
I that's always a term. As somebody who's spent time in places and worked in and on various countries that people have at various times described as failed states, I think it's a little bit of a loaded term, so I hesitate to apply it. But certainly Haiti has huge systematic problems domestically in terms of its political system, in terms of its economy, that are recurring and have been recurring issues really since the 1990s, really even prior to that. But we've seen just kind of a series of political crises from Haiti intersecting and in some vicious feedback loops with its economic crises of various sorts, and of course penetrated by earth-shattering earthquakes in 2010 and subsequently, there have been subsequent earthquakes as well, though not quite at the same scale, that are truly devastating and contribute to this terrible humanitarian situation. And so it is a failed state is again, a loaded term I hesitate to use, but not an unfair way to describe it. And notably, it's really the view that a lot of different civil society groups have taken in Haiti, some of the activist groups that are very critical of what they see as a very kind of corruption infested status quo in the political elites, and that they see the current kind of incumbent leadership, which took over after the assassination of Jovenel Moïse, who was previously prime minister last year. He's now been replaced by somebody who some people have accused of or spread rumors about actually being involved in that assassination, although we don't know to what degree those are actually substantiated or simply a political tool. So there's no real clear way out is really the answer. And you can hear that in commentaries on these sorts of approaches that the United States and other allied governments have taken on this latest crisis. Haiti is a country that has experienced a lot of external interventions in the recent past. The United States has intervened militarily twice arguably three times, although once was in response to the 2010 earthquake. So a little bit of a mixed case there, but both in 1996 and 2004, I believe. And those were, you know, pretty dramatic actions intending to try and stabilize the political situation in Haiti, in part because the consequence of instability in Haiti are felt in the United States through, you know, Haitians trying to flee the country by boat to American shores, particularly in the 1990s. That proved to be a major domestic political crisis for the Clinton administration. That certainly entered into the calculation about intervening in the country there. I think the Bush administration may have been worried about the same thing in the 2000s, perhaps motivating some intervention there as well. But at the same time, those interventions are wildly controversial among a lot of Haitians, among a lot of outside folks. The last UN mission that kind of followed the US intervention in the 2000s was accused of corruption, accused of spreading sexually transmitted diseases and engaging a lot of negative impacts, and particularly devastating the Haitian economy, because these, you know, foreign interventions bring with them huge amounts of funds and money and foreign assistance that can really crowd out a domestic economy. So long story short, there's just no clear, easy path out about how to deal with this. And all people can really settle on is saying, well, we're just going to try and get the parties on the ground into some sort of framework. The people have even moved away from elections towards some sort of political framework to restore some sort of functioning stability. But I haven't really heard many compelling stories about how exactly you go about doing that. And I think that's the real challenge at this point. How do you do that? And how do you even get things stable enough that you can have a realistic conversation about the parties doing that? You know, elections just don't seem feasible at this particular point, in part because gangs are trying to control territory so they can help control election results. So it's just not clear. There's no easy path out for this particular crisis that I can see.
One point on which I will confess I'm somewhat baffled and confused. Am I right that almost a year later, over a year later, we still have no definitive answer as to who or what was behind Jovenel Moïse's assassination? I know that there has been at least one Colombian indicted in the United States, but when I was reading up the New York Times coverage on that, the paper indicated that basically it seems like this guy was involved. It was probably planned in the United States, and that's what they got. It seems quite astonishing that the leader of a country was assassinated over a year ago, and still nobody has any idea why that happened or who was behind it.
There was a late 2021 New York Times article that suggested that this may have been connected to Moïse's attempt to crack down on the drug trade in Haiti. But I think the problem is that given Haiti's current political instability, right, which has lasted for decades, it's kind of overdetermined what faction, what gang, what group might want to get rid of the leader. So I don't think there's anything definitive.
I think that's right. And my understanding is the investigation is ongoing. You have a federal prosecution taking place in the United States precisely because there is a U.S. jurisdictional nexus because of the degree of planning that took place there. There are actually federal laws specifically outlawing efforts to organize insurrections in foreign countries from the United States, interestingly, because this isn't the first time this has happened, for better or for worse. I don't know if that's what this person's being charged under or not. I would have to go back and double check that. But there is an investigation ongoing. There is supposedly involvement with Haitian authorities. You've had a lot of local governments. There's Colombian paramilitaries were involved, people who are alumnus of Colombian security forces and were kind of private security people, were the people who actually pulled the trigger and killed Moïse. At least one of them has been arrested. I think that's actually the individual who is believed to be cooperating, was eventually extradited to the United States or voluntarily traveled to the United States to avoid extradition elsewhere, I think towards the end of 2021. So the investigation is kind of ongoing, but it is a little striking here. And it enters into this latest crisis because allegations of different people being involved with the assassination have become a major political tool among the different factions of elites and have proved been used to, rightly or wrongly, delegitimize, among other people, the incumbent Prime Minister Ariel Henry, who was, if I'm recalling correctly, at one point an ally of Moïse, originally was not, there's some lack of clarity what the line of succession was after Moïse was assassinated, but eventually he ended up kind of rising to that seat and has held it for most of the last year, or maybe a little more than a year now. But it's still a controversial figure because of those ties. I will note, I did a phenomenal discussion on the Lawfare podcast a year ago, right after the Moïse assassination, with Robert Fetton of the University of Virginia. Highly, highly recommend folks revisit that. We may try and get him on the Lawfare podcast again sometime soon to talk through this latest crisis with us, but haven't had the opportunity to do so thus far.
Yeah, I'll just say that was a fantastic conversation. And I think one of the things that really came through from it is that after the Moïse killing, there were sort of a nesting doll of constitutional crises within one another, none of which seem to have been resolved. I will say, I just looked it up. So the Colombian man who was who's being prosecuted is Mario Palacios, and he is being prosecuted for a conspiracy to commit murder or kidnapping outside the United States. So Scott, I don't know if that was the statute that you had in mind. I mean, one thing that I will add here, and not to be the person who every time Haiti comes up in a conversation within the United States, I do think it's impossible to talk about the situation of Haiti right now without talking about the really interesting historical work that's been done on the sort of looting of Haiti by France after Haiti fought for and won its independence. So the Times had a really astonishing series in the spring 2022, building on a lot of historical work that was basically quantifying the amount that Haiti had to pay back to France, paying reparations to former slave masters and then paying back a loan that Haiti took out to pay those reparations. So according to the Times, it seems like their estimate is that it cost Haiti anywhere from $21 billion to $115 billion in lost economic growth over time. Which I think certainly helps put in context why the country is in such desperate straits today. And I mean, I think also raises this complicated question of, you know, what do these former imperial powers owe to Haiti, especially now that it's in such a desperate situation?
Well, I think that's in part what makes the question of intervention that much more complicated. I mean, you're absolutely right. The reason in part that Haiti, maybe the main reason that Haiti is in such difficult straits, is because after the Haitian Revolution, the imperial powers, not just France, but, you know, even ones that were moving away from slavery, like England, they all sort of boycotted the Haitian economy, because just the idea of a black slave revolt against European power was ideologically, I don't even know, distasteful, let's say, to the European imperialists. So, you know, Haiti has always suffered from this sort of path-dependent structural disadvantage. And so it makes sense that for that reason also, Haitians would be quite ambivalent about a modern-day Monroe Doctrine, right, under which the United States says, well, you know, Haiti is very close to Puerto Rico, it's very close to the mainland, I guess it's going to be, quote-unquote, our problem. Or even just a more global intervention by the UN, right, which obviously is controlled in large part and influenced in large part by the kind of former European and imperial powers. On the other hand, the answer can't just be, well, we did a bunch of bad things in the past, therefore, you know, being more involved raises awkward questions, therefore we will let this country of millions of people sink into literal anarchy. I mean, I guess you can ignore Haiti for a while. It's an island, which makes it maybe a little bit more difficult for migrants to leave, though obviously they can find a way. Obviously, it's not the entirety of the island of Hispaniola, right? There's the Dominican Republic, but they've been busy building a wall between the two countries. So maybe they can control the exodus of migrants. But I all of this is just to say I've been surprised by the fact that the implosion, and again, I don't say any of these pejoratively, right? It's just about the horrible situation that the Haitian people find themselves in. The implosion of this country that is so close to the United States just has not seemed to enter into the national conversation, I think, in part because of some isolationism and in part because maybe a left-wing reluctance to do anything that smacks of neo-imperialism, which again is understandable given the historical context, but seems increasingly untenable given what is just happening on the ground. I don't know where this goes, but it's, I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I tend to agree with that. We have a problem with when we talk about intervention, both because we don't define very well what that means. Like, what does intervention mean? Does it mean, are we talking about political intervention? We just mean military intervention. When we problematize that, do we mean a whole range of engagement with foreign countries, particularly weaker foreign countries? That's usually the context in which it's most problematic. And beyond that, in addition, we don't tend to really lay out, in effort to kind of say, what is it that different types of intervention can do and can't do effectively? I think we, instead, the United States and other major powers tend to oscillate wildly between the two. We go through periods like we had right after the 9/11 attacks, or frankly, before the 9/11 attacks as well, throughout the 90s and early 2000s, where people were wildly optimistic about what we can accomplish with military interventions, particularly in smaller countries, you know, pursued a large number of them. Then in the last few years, people, I think, have understandably become much more skeptical of what sort of accomplishments can be accomplished, even with like large scale occupations and interventions overseas, like in Iraq and Afghanistan, neither of which has ended as any people hoped they would, and anywhere close to the way people hoped they would 20 years ago when we started them. And that has people wildly skeptical, that particularly when combined with the post very challenging post-colonial history, colonial and post-colonial history of places like Haiti, makes this such an anathema kind of third rail for a lot of people to begin talking about. At the same time, you know, I don't know if there is clearly, like, if there is something that a, particularly even a military intervention can accomplish, it is to restore security situations in certain areas, right? In the short term, so long as you have a military presence there. The U.S. interventions in 96 and 2004 did do that. They didn't solve the underlying problem. They arguably aggravated certain aspects of the problem that made it maybe more systematic and worse, but they did at least provide that momentary element of increased stability. And there are maybe solutions that that can be a part of, that I think the inclination is perhaps it's too easy for people to lean and write that off and group that in with much different types and broader types of intervention. People tend to think of it as a binary. And I think we have to disaggregate the whole range of policy options a little bit more than that. That said, I tend to be, in most circumstances, I tend to be somebody who's very skeptical of particularly military intervention, because I just don't think it can often accomplish that much. The United States tends to be wildly bullish on what it can do with its military, and I think it wildly exaggerates that. And that might be a case like this here. But I also think it is a tool in the toolkit that people need to have a conversation about. And that conversation needs to be, you know, a little more nuanced than simply revisiting past misuses of that tool.
Yeah. So one point before we close, I think that since we were referencing, you know, what effects we might see from this crisis in the United States, just immediately follow-on effects, there has been a surge in people trying to travel to the United States from Haiti because of the violence and instability in that country. So if listeners remember, there was a controversy, I think about a year or so ago, where a Border Patrol agent on a horse seemed to be attacking a Haitian man trying to cross the Rio Grande with a whip. It later turned out that that was not precisely what happened, but it was what happened was still pretty bad, and DHS was quite apologetic about it, for what it's worth. And the Biden administration has been expelling Haitians who crossed into the United States back to Haiti. There's the most recent report I could find about this was in June 2022. I think it is still going on, although I'm not 100% sure, because the U.S., under the immigration structure that the U.S. is currently operating with, we have a diplomatic relationship with Haiti where we can send people back. So people are trying to escape, and the United States has been stepping up efforts to put them right back where they started. So I believe this current increase in people from Haiti trying to travel to the United States began after the Moïse assassination. I don't know, but I guess I wouldn't be surprised if we see another increase of people trying to leave as the current situation deteriorates. And I would hope, but have no expectation, that the United States would do something other than just send them right back to where they came from.
No, I think that's a really astute observation, Quinta, and something worth bearing in mind. We don't see the, you know, Haitian immigration flows being the high profile story that they were 20 years ago today, but they were a very high profile story 20 years ago. And there have actually been a very big focus of U.S. policy in a lot of very problematic ways, and a lot of people's views, including mine, about controlling those population flows in response to the variety of Haitian crises. And again, that has driven, frankly, at least two prior presidential administrations of different parties to eventually intervene in Haiti when faced with really dire consequences. The Biden administration's in a really unique political moment in a way. It has really kind of hung its hat on being the wind-up administration, the administration that's less inclined to do military intervention, winding up conflict in Iraq, winding up conflict in Afghanistan, engaging in Ukraine, but in a very limited way, a little bullish on Taiwan. That's one area where maybe it departs from this trend, but generally seems less inclined to foreign intervention, you know, less active in expanding global war on terror, winding down engagement with different theaters. But this could end up being a real test of that and the limits of that to a certain extent. Again, if you have a real crisis brewing so close to the United States, you know, policymakers are going to be left struggling for options. It's worth noting the prior two administrations opted to eventually intervene in Haiti when they did, without congressional authorization. There are Office of Legal Counsel opinions on the books basically laying out the case why they think that sort of intervention, which presumably this would look a lot like, of which was substantial, in one case over 20,000 U.S. troops, I believe, were involved, don't require congressional authorization. I think dynamics are a little different from the Biden administration politically, and the dynamics around U.S. military involvement overseas are very different today than they were in the 90s and the 2000s. But I think it may end up being a conversation if you end up having this crisis continue to develop in this way, because again, people are going to be left really struggling for any tool they can bring to bear on the scenario. And that is one the United States has and could even very plausibly get international support for it like they did in the 2000s, although it will certainly prove controversial in the region and in Haiti and domestically. So something worth keeping our eye on in terms of the menu of possible crises the United States might face. Here's a dark horse candidate for one that might become more significant at some point sooner rather than later. Well, going from anarchy in the Caribbean, let's go to anarchy on the Fifth Circuit, because the Fifth Circuit has done something very interesting in this last week that you two have certainly been following for a long time. Alan, you just published a really wonderful read on Lawfare. I recommend people check out, both summarizing and critiquing this opinion. But let me take a shot at breaking it down. You all can correct me where I get it wrong.
Godspeed, John Glenn.
I'm going to do it very high level, but essentially, there is a law that Texas enacted that seeks to regulate how social media platforms engage in content moderation in various ways. We can get in the details on that. That law was originally enjoined as a First Amendment violation by a district court. That district court, there are some machinations involving the Supreme Court briefly about that. And then that decision now has been overturned by the Fifth Circuit that says there is no First Amendment issue here in a case that adopts a particularly narrow view of the First Amendment, I would say, at least in terms of how it regards of critiquing. Certainly, it does not view this law as a clear facial First Amendment violation the same way the district court did. And because of that, that means this law very well might move into operation in the near future, putting a real question to social media platforms how exactly they're going to do this while they wait on appeal and see what further options. Although I don't think necessarily they couldn't seek some other sort of injunction moving forward or stay. We don't know if they've done that yet, but I suspect they will at least try and get one down the road. But in the meantime, Alan, tell us a little bit more, dig into us a little more deeply on your critiques of this opinion, why it's significant, what I got wrong, if I got anything wrong. I don't think I did. I think I nailed it. And where we can go from there.
tens across the board. Yeah. So, I mean, there's so much to talk about, and Quinta has just as much to say as I do. So I'm going to try to sort of cut to what I think is, for me, the problem with this opinion. And this is very much my view. I should say I am someone who is, in principle, actually quite sympathetic, at least to the idea of some government regulation over content moderation policies. Mostly, I'm just very unsympathetic to extravagant claims of First Amendment protections by technology companies. I just think that's a very blunt instrument that gives these multi, you know, I think in Apple's case, multi like trillion dollar, I mean, just enormous companies, really extreme constitutional protections. So I was kind of excited to read the opinion because I thought, you know, maybe it's thoughtful, maybe it's interesting. And I mean, even I this piece that I wrote for Lawfare is, I think, maybe the spiciest I've ever gotten about a judicial opinion because it's really very bad. And the fundamental way that I think it's bad is as follows. There's a tendency, what I've been calling First Amendment absolutism, for both sides in this debate to view the answer as super obvious. Either the First Amendment applies to platform content moderation decisions, and because it applies, it's almost impossible for any government regulation to pass constitutional scrutiny because the First Amendment is a particularly powerful amendment, right? It's a particularly powerful right in American constitutional law. And I think you've seen that that's sort of been the position of the platforms. It's been the position of, I think, a lot of scholars, a lot of digital civil society types. I think that's changed over the last couple of years, but that's really been the dominant position. And I've spent the last couple of years in various contexts arguing against that. But then there's the reverse part of this, which is its own kind of absolutism, which is that there's no First Amendment protection at all here, because this isn't speech, this is censorship. A line that in some permutation the court uses like 24 times. It just seems to think that repeating something over and over again is equivalent to legal analysis, which I found one of the many annoying pieces of this opinion. And I think the answer is pretty obviously that it's somewhere in the middle, that when these companies moderate, which they do with a combination of automated and individualized means, they are certainly expressing something. And more important than even that, they are shaping the communicative environment in which all these users operate. So what that means is that I do think the First Amendment has a role, in particular to make sure that government regulation isn't overbroad, doesn't, you know, single out certain points of view, or doesn't ruin the communicative space for everyone. But it shouldn't be absolute, because these are our digital commons, and it's just a mistake to leave that to the market. Now, how you translate into the doctrine is a little complicated, because the Supreme Court opinions on this are a little bit all over the place, and they are fundamentally mostly about 20th century technology, and they just haven't been updated for the 21st century. They ultimately come down to this question of, as a doctrinal matter, are platforms more like newspapers, in which case they have very, very strong protections for their editorial decisions, or are they more like, let's say, a shopping mall that can be allowed, that can be forced to allow anyone to you know, distribute political literature, or a college campus that can be forced to allow military recruiters to come on campus, right? These are two Supreme Court cases that allowed this sort of government control over what we might think of as a kind of content moderation. And so a lot of these fights, whether it's the Fifth Circuit decision upholding the Texas case, or this summer's 11th Circuit decision that struck down a related Florida content moderation bill, are having this fight over, well, are platforms like newspapers, or are they like shopping malls? And the answer is, well, like, they're neither. They're like their own thing. They're a revolutionary technology, not quite on par with the printing press, but I don't know, within the same order of magnitude as important. And so, you know, to me, the project, and no one has done this well, frankly, the Fifth Circuit got least of all, is to rebuild First Amendment doctrine for this new category of entities, and instead of relying on these outmoded cases, to ask ourselves, what is it that we are trying to accomplish, and what sort of government regulations are good at that? The Fifth Circuit does not do that. And the Texas law is also just absurd. It is super vague. It is super broad. It prohibits content moderation on the basis of political viewpoint, which, I mean, no one knows what it is, but it seems to pretty obviously lead to policy absurdities, like platforms not being permitted to remove terrorist or Nazi content. And although the Fifth Circuit says these are all just hypotheticals, they're not hypotheticals. Like, most of social media is Nazi and terrorist content if you don't have pretty strong content moderation. I mean, that and, you know, pornography and advertisements for getting more car warranties. And so it's just a really unfortunate example of how you can get kind of a little high in your supply and just not address an issue that is super important with anything like the nuance that it should. To be clear, I don't mean that the opposite of the Fifth Circuit decision would be a beneficial one. There are plenty of people critiquing the Fifth Circuit saying, oh, the First Amendment applies, this is a simple case, any regulation is essentially unconstitutional. I disagree with those people 100% as well. It's just that the Fifth Circuit is, you know, one example of a particularly bad kind of intellectual pathology. And if you want to read 4,500 words about that, there's a Lawfare post about it.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Yeah, I think I agree mostly with what Alan said. I would be harsher in some respects. I mean, I think that the really important thing to underline here is that, Scott, I will ding you on one part of your presentation, which is that the Texas law has two, you can split it into two components. There's the content moderation portion, and there's a transparency reporting provision. And I do think it's important to distinguish between those because they do raise different First Amendment questions. And I think that even if you take the view that the First Amendment prohibits anything like the content moderation portions, I think that there's a much stronger case for the transparency provisions. The tech companies have been arguing against both of those, but I don't think, as Alan says, this doesn't have to be, you know, a yes or a no answer. There can be many shades of gray, and we should be looking to, you know, find those and identify them and think seriously about where in that spectrum, you know, good tech policy lies. That said, this is not a good faith example of a court trying to grapple with these problems. I think that the 11th Circuit decision on a sort of similar, though not identical, Florida law was. I know Alan disagreed with the 11th Circuit's ruling. It took I don't know what we wanted, stricter, looser, a view that the First Amendment prohibited some regulation that Alan personally would like.
But I was much nicer about it.
Yes, right, and rightly so, because it was an example of, you know, an appeals court trying to genuinely grapple with an unsettled area of law and policy in a rapidly changing world, and doing so in a way that you or I may not 100% agree with, but I think it was done in good faith, and it was a serious attempt to address these problems. The Fifth Circuit decision is not only wrong, but it is not a serious attempt to understand any of this. Like, it's wrong. It's wrong factually. It's wrong on the law in any number of ways, and wrong not in the sense that it like disagrees with existing doctrine and wants it to change. It just straight up misstates things multiple times. I think Daphne Keller, who has been for her sins really, really closely following this litigation, tweeted a number of good Twitter threads about it. But one of the things that she said was that it reminded her of, you know, the way that a bully talks. Like, it's just smarmy. It doesn't try to make legal arguments because it doesn't have to, because it can just do whatever it wants. And I think that you see that in the way that it addresses this question of precedent, where there is this just truly bananas line where the court says, as we always do, and now I'll start paraphrasing, essentially, we're going to look at the original meaning of the First Amendment. And weirdly, the tech companies, they didn't do that. They looked at Supreme Court precedents, but we're going to start with originalism. Now, okay, so if you are Clarence Thomas, yes, you can do that because you're on the Supreme Court. This is the Fifth Circuit. That's not what you do in the Fifth. Like, what is even happening here? And that, I think, is really a clue that the train has just completely left the station. So I think that I worry, honestly, that even breaking down the different legal components of this ruling and the different questions of doctrine and law and policy that it raises is in a weird way giving it too much credit, because it's just like a giant middle finger at everybody. And that is the level of analysis it deserves.
So I want to set aside the tone issues, right? I think that's a problem with this opinion. This judge is not unique for being a dick. Judges are dicks sometimes. And it's like just a reality, unfortunately.
Listener, that almost made me choke on my coffee.
But it's flat out true, unfortunately.
Scott, you are right, but there is a foot stomp, as they say, what Quinta said. There's a difference between the tone, which I agree is obnoxious, but whatever. And the statement that I will just read the sentence, because it really is completely nuts. Rather than mount any challenge under the original public meaning of the First Amendment, the platforms instead focus their attention on Supreme Court doctrine. Like, that's an insane statement. That's not an issue of tone. That's an issue of a kind of aggressive judicial lawlessness that views its role not as trying to faithfully apply precedent, but as trying to, trying to predict where a new conservative majority is going to go and get there before they do. And it's that's a legal problem. That's not a tone problem.
And I also think that, Scott, I know you actually wanted to ask a question, but before you do that.
Not even the first sentence over.
You can even critique that on originalist grounds, right? So like Evan Burnick, who's a law professor, who's I think would identify himself as an originalist, but has thought very deeply about originalism, was tweeting like, this is not like, I don't know what this is, but it's not necessarily, you know, originalism does not mean that you have to take this crazy stance.
Oh, no, I'm sure that's absolutely right, because originalism rarely leads to just one firm conclusion, which is part of like the issue with starting with originalism, right? But setting this aside, right, the problem you have with revolutionary judges or, you know, kind of consciously disruptive judges is that they are subject to appeal, right? So this is now going to go before the Fifth Circuit en banc, potentially, then potentially the Supreme Court. And there's already a split with the 11th Circuit. So unless the en banc, you know, aligns itself with the 11th Circuit to some degree more, the incentive for the Supreme Court to take it up is pretty significant. Question I have is, you know, setting aside this judge's failures to wrestle with us and the panel's failures to wrestle with it, although the dynamics about amending a judge's opinion are always very interesting and very idiosyncratic. So really it's the author who deserves the brunt of it, particularly when it comes to tone and framing, in my view. The question I have is, you know, how do you square the circle, particularly Alan, who wants to see his middle road opinion, right? Because it's very easy to say, look, I think there's a little bit of both sides in this. Like, I like to see little column A, little column B, and the answer is somewhere in the middle. But it's actually very challenging at times, particularly in a place like First Amendment doctrine, where you are specifically talking about the government's regulation of something, to say, where do we draw that line and how do we draw that line? Right now, I think that, frankly, has been a contributing factor to the fact that we've seen a right and left consensus around very bold, broad First Amendment doctrine, really, for the last 20 or 30 years, right? And to an extent that I think is actually not entirely warranted and problematic at some of its extremes, although for most of it, I buy, you know, 90, 80% of it. Where do you draw that line? Because it strikes me as kind of a hard case here. Like, I don't agree with this outcome of this opinion. I sympathize with you, though, that like there probably is a reasonable space where you could have some regulation here before you really get at real concrete First Amendment rights. But, you know, how do you draw the line in a way that's going to be enforceable in a way that's comfortable for the government to apply, for the courts to apply, for the federal or state governments to apply? Like, where would you draw that line?
Yeah, no. So look, this is a very fair question. And you know, this is the classic, in some sense, all legal questions come down to the debate between rules versus standards, right? You have rules that are clear, they're easy to apply, but they're just inaccurate because life is complicated. And then you have standards, or, you know, Breyerisms, however you want to call them, right? Which all involve 27 factor tests, which are impossible to apply. And we all make fun of them, but actually, if you do it well, track reality better, because again, reality is complicated. I would say a couple of things. I do think there's a path forward here. It's called intermediate scrutiny. It is a existing and well-established tier of scrutiny, as they say, in constitutional adjudication. I'm going to get the verbiage a little wrong, but it basically asks, look, is the government interest important, right? Does the government law further that interest? And is it overly burdensome? Right. So it's intermediate because it's intermediate between strict scrutiny, which basically, you know, almost never allows government action to go through because it has really, really high threat standards, and rational basis scrutiny, which basically always allows government action to go through. Again, I'm hugely oversimplifying. In the rest of the world, intermediate scrutiny is basically called proportionality analysis. And it's how most advanced constitutional democracies deal with difficult rights-based questions when the answer is not obvious and every side has a fair point. Okay, so how do you do that? Well, the key to intermediate scrutiny and proportionality analysis is that you have to focus a lot on the specific issue in front of you, right? And so you have to start through a common law process of looking at facts, looking at laws that come before you, start making judgments about specific issues rather than making really bold claims like speech isn't censorship or content moderation is as First Amendment protected as, you know, what I say to my friends on this podcast. Now, people are going to draw these lines in different places, 100%. Now, one of the reasons we have a Supreme Court is because we need, or we've decided in our infinite wisdom, to have a super legislature that decides these questions for us. I'm not thrilled with the composition of the Supreme Court, but you know, you have to decide these questions somehow. And a court that is relatively humble, I'm not saying this court is, but a court that is relatively humble and answers these questions in limited ways, you know, can over time develop a body of law that makes some amount of sense, which is frankly what they have done in 50 years of the First Amendment as applied to commercial entities, right? The so-called commercial speech doctrine, which makes all these fine distinctions. So how would you do that in this case? I don't know, to be honest. You know, I will say I, you know, maybe this is the next Law Review article I write where I actually try to figure out how to do this now that I keep whining about it so much. Personally, I think the Florida law is, I think the combination of the Florida law's tighter scoping, the Florida law doesn't apply to content moderation generally. It applies specifically to politicians and media outlets, right? And I think there's a lot to be said for having a narrower focus on those two entities. Combining that narrower scope with the remedial provisions of the Texas law, which are basically limited to injunctive relief rather than the very extreme monetary penalties that the Florida law does. I think something like that, I could imagine if you massaged it carefully enough, could be the sort of thing we could try out for a while and see if it worked, right? I would be comfortable-ish on that, right? Now, look, I also have my own priors, right? You know, I have my own views on whether Donald Trump should have been kicked off Twitter. I think at the end of the day, he probably shouldn't have been. A lot of people disagree with that. And so under the Florida law, probably really hard to kick him off.
You should have saved that for our hot
take. That should have been my super hot take. So I get that we disagree, but that's what we do in a society where you have difficult constitutional issues. My point is there needs to be a process by which we can think through these difficult problems, because right now you just have two sides screaming at each other at the top of their lungs, making no progress. And I think anyone who thinks that this is as a policy matter, an easy question is just kidding themselves and is just unserious.
I don't know, folks. I've been trying to improve my transitions, but this time I don't really know.
No excuses.
Yeah, I don't know, man. I got, well.
From one crazy thing involving the state of Texas and the state of Florida to another crazy thing involving the states of Texas and Florida.
That's so weak. So
that's pretty good, I thought.
Okay, let's just, you know what? Let's go with that. Texas. So in the news recently, you might have seen, has been a truly weird story about migrants being shipped by the states of Texas and Florida to Martha's Vineyard and also the U.S. Naval Observatory, a.k.a. the vice president's residence, which is just a few miles from me in scenic Washington, D.C. So the idea of moving migrants who come across the southern border by bus is not new. Texas in particular has been doing it for a while. I know the details are complicated and it can be done in cruel and frustrating ways. Sometimes, you know, people really would like a lift to New York, for example. If they have family there, it might be easier to get a job, easier to travel around. But in the case that has been taking up a lot of attention recently, the state of Florida paid for a group of migrants to be flown from a county in Texas to Florida, and then from Florida to, of all places, Martha's Vineyard, where, weirdly, someone seems to have tipped off Fox News, but not, say, the government of Massachusetts, that these people would be arriving. So Martha's Vineyard, not actually a particularly big town, especially in the off season. There were some, you know, very heartwarming photos of people coming together to provide clothes and shelter and so on. And I believe those migrants who wanted to have now been helped to travel to a military base that's on the Massachusetts mainland, which is important because if you've crossed the border without authorization, you actually need to be able to check in regularly at a courthouse, lest you put yourself at risk for deportation. And Martha's Vineyard, I'm guessing there are actually not a lot of courthouses. So being on the Massachusetts mainland, say with easy to travel to Boston, is a useful thing. So anyway, this is becoming, I think, a relatively fast-moving scandal, not only because it's not clear whether or not it was legal to do this in the first place. These people did not know that they were going to Martha's Vineyard. They didn't know that nobody knew that they were coming. it's not clear whether or not DeSantis properly used the money in question, the money from the Florida government, to send these people there. And it's also obviously just unbelievably cruel to use people as pawns in this way and kind of say, ha-ha, you said that you liked, you know, people who come to the U.S. without documentation. Here are some of them, which is just a, whatever your political point, it's an appalling way to treat people. So I don't know. I mean, my sense is that this has the potential to be a really, like a potentially a genuine scandal, less because of the astonishing cruelty and more because of the potential illegality and sort of weird hinky stuff around the margins. Alan, let me throw it over to you. What do you make of it?
Yeah, I mean, I think David French, who's a conservative and is on the, you know, did the Dispatch conservative podcast, I think he said it best, which is, I'm against using people as props, full stop. And I think it's just, we should just keep repeating that over and over again until that sinks in. It's just an unbelievable, cruel thing to do. You know, one thing that's particularly depressing and a reflection of our politics is that the cruelty was the point, in a sense. There's a question of, you know, trolling the libs and trolling progressive cities and showing how, you know, NIMBY they can be and, you know, showing how hypocritical they can be about migrants. And we should talk about that, right? But ultimately, the other reason DeSantis did this was to show that he is a strong, you know, strong leader that's willing to protect the border at all costs. And that I think the cruelty was honestly part of it. And, you know, cue the discussion about the urbanization of Florida, which maybe we'll have time to get into. You know, the legal questions are interesting. You know, I just don't know, right? I think it depends a lot on the facts. Exactly what did they know? Exactly what were they told? You know, at least on the criminal front, whether this was also a violation of Florida statute is an interesting question. And I agree that it could be a real problem for DeSantis, not just kind of immediate in the sense of legal liability, but also because I think it punctures a little bit the idea that DeSantis is a competent Trump. Maybe he's just Trump. Just less charismatic, but equally incompetent. That's a quite interesting possibility. You know, at the same time, I do think it's important to recognize that this incident, which again, I mean, everything about this sucks and DeSantis is the worst. There's no question about that. This incident is one incident in a much broader question about how to deal with migrants at the border and specifically how to deal with border towns in the South whose, you know, social services are just as, if not more stressed than that of not Martha's Vineyard, but, you know, New York City or Chicago or, you know, towns that have declared themselves to be sanctuary cities and so forth, right? Like there's plenty of hypocrisy to go around. And I think it's unfortunate, you know, the right has totally lost the thread of this conversation, but I think the left has a little bit too. Quinta is smirking at as she sees that I'm going into my usual both sides-ism.
I'm just impressed that you managed to take a story about essentially kidnapping morally, if not legally, people, sending them to a small island off the coast of Massachusetts without their permission, and still we're both sides of it.
Yeah. I'm very talented like that, right? I mean, I think that there's a larger conversation about what we owe to border towns and the fact that border towns complain about, you know, whose border towns, the demographics of which are often quite similar to the migrants that they are dealing with, that when they complain about the overload, that's not just racism, right? Which is what I think many unreflective progressives who don't deal with these issues will often say. So I'm just saying there's a bigger story here. And for completeness' sake, we, maybe not the three of us, but we should talk about it.
Well, I don't disagree with that take, but I'm actually not sure it actually captures the actual dynamics of this particular controversy, at least as it's breaking out so far, right? Like we've seen both Governor Abbott in Texas, who's been doing a similar thing about busing people to Chicago, New York, and DC. I think Chicago hasn't happened yet, but it's happening this week. It has actually come under increased skepticism from both the right and the left. Like the left that this is just an inhumane thing to do. And you actually have critics on the right saying, this is a huge public service you're providing, facilitating illegal migration. You have people crossing the border precisely because they want to get to locations north and places where they have strong social services, and you are providing them a speedway for doing that. In that sense, like I actually think your point about this, Alan, about maybe this is just a sign that this wasn't that bright a thing to do in the first place, like kind of might capture it, right? And it's interesting because it was very, particularly in the DeSantis case, like really premeditated. This was something they got a $12 million for in the state budget. This costs about $1 million. So in theory, they can do this 11 more times roughly, right? And they were warned by members of the Republican Party in the Florida state legislature, hey, let's have a carve out for this to make sure that none of this money is used for example, people fleeing communist governments or dictatorial governments. Because in Florida, there's a very big Cuban population that's very sensitive about that sort of thing. And so it's really unique, particularly to see a Florida politician really take this sort of stance or roll this sort of dice, or at least fail to do this due diligence after having been warned in advance. Part of it might just be a degree of incompetence. Part of it also, I suspect, might be the fact that DeSantis is actually probably looking to a national stage and not a state stage at this point, and sees the trade-offs of being able to say something to a national audience might outweigh the domestic or statewide cost for him in Florida, which it seems like there are going to be some. I mean, the reaction of Florida Republicans has not been one of vocal, overwhelming support for DeSantis' action in this regard, which I think is itself really interesting and also hints at some of the challenges, frankly, that this kind of next generation post-Trump GOP leadership might have in capturing the bottle of Trumpism, because Trumpism is, to some degree, such a freewheeling figure when it comes from Donald Trump, not true and you're an established politician who needs to maintain constituencies that have local interests that don't always align with the national, you know, far-right zeitgeist. So it really raised, I think, a lot of interesting questions to watch where this goes. I strongly suspect we're not going to see many more of these because, frankly, I think you've already seen a criminal investigation launched in Texas. I think you're going to see a federal criminal investigation. I don't know if it's going to go anywhere. I kind of doubt it leads to charges. But you actually look at the Justice Manual, what the Department of Justice says about kidnapping statutes and relevant statutes, which I think could apply here, although I don't know if it's a strong case. I kind of doubt it is. But they say, actually, if there's even signs of a possible case of kidnapping, we investigate it as a matter of policy. They have a very aggressive lean forward investigatory posture about those sorts of things. And this seems like it would tip into that to some substantial regard, particularly, frankly, with a Justice Department that admittedly is run by people who probably are far less sympathetic to this than maybe a Trump Justice Department might have been, right? And when you start having FBI agents or state investigators call airline companies and bus companies and say, well, you know, you were engaged in a criminal conspiracy, potentially, tell us about what you know and do lengthy interviews with them, they're going to get scared away from doing it. And I think it's going to be harder. So it's, I think it's much more interesting probably as just a sense of a wind vane about telling us which way is this blowing and how easy is it for these sorts of figures to try and do these very Trumpy things while they're still holding gubernatorial office, right? Like most politicians come from a political background. They aren't like Donald Trump where they just come out of the media atmosphere. And it's a lot more challenging to tack that path correctly than I think a lot of people appreciate.
I look forward to when the Fifth and 11th circuits discover a executive privilege for busing companies communications with governors.
It's the First Amendment, Alan.
of course. Censorship. big bus censorship. So I know we're running low on time, but I did want to ask Quinto sort of one question, because I did tease the DeSantis Orban thing, which I know is a hobby horse for both of us. I am curious, I mean, what do you make about just the politics of this in the context, because this is RatSec, right, not on the old podcast, in the context of, you know, democracy stuff with regard to DeSantis. My instinct, I ask this because my instinct, I think, initially was this can't be good for DeSantis because it gives him, it may be the most national indication yet, or it is the most nationally cementing action of his meanness, just cruelty. And, you know, generally Americans like nice people, but of course they elected Donald Trump in 2016. So what the hell do I know? What is your sense about whether this improves DeSantis's obvious, I think beyond a reasonable doubt, ambitions to be president in 2024 or 2028, or if it hurts him? Cause this was just mean, man, too mean.
So I don't think that meanness hurts him, because we've seen that his really astonishing cruelty toward gay and trans people and children in Florida seems to have paid really enormous political dividends. Maybe it's a matter of being mean to the wrong people. There's an incredible quote. I cannot for the life of me remember the context, but there's a woman who had voted for Trump and felt like she was not getting what she needed from him because her community had sort of been left without defense after some kind of disaster, and told the New York Times that she was disappointed with Trump because, and I quote, he's not hurting the right people. So that's sort of Trumpism in a nutshell. And I wonder whether part of DeSantis's problem here is that he hurt the wrong people, right? He hurt, among others, a lot of Venezuelan immigrants who are sort of similarly situated to the Cuban immigrant community in Florida, insofar as they're literally fleeing communism, no matter what your opinion is of the Maduro government, and that makes it much harder for DeSantis to kind of position this as something that needed to be done, because these are the people, you know, he's positioning himself as, you know, he's fighting communism, he's fighting for free speech, et cetera, et cetera. It's a lot more difficult to make that argument if you're sending Venezuelans to Martha's Vineyard without their permission. I also think that my sense of DeSantis, and I think I said this on the Hot Take show, has always been that there's a calculating edge to him that Trump just doesn't have, and that can play to his advantage because it means that he's a little more canny. I think it can also play to his disadvantage because he loses some of that kind of authenticity and spontaneity that I think is a lot of what draws people to Trump. And I actually think that the way that this was so clearly premeditated, and premeditated in like the weirdest possible way, like you take people from Texas and you touch down in Florida, and then it's just strange. And I do wonder whether the sort of choreographed element of it really undercuts a lot of the power that he was trying to draw on.
Do we know, by the way, why they touched down in Florida first?
So I believe that they touched down in Florida. I think this is from a Miami Herald reporting. My impression is that the money that was used to pay for this is from a national pot of COVID funds that was given to states.
Of course it was.
Certain states,
from the interest on those funds.
Right. Yes, thank you. Including Texas and Florida then passed laws saying that they could use that money for other purposes, including immigration policy, and that the Florida statute specifies that the immigrants in question who the funds are being used to address in some way have to be in Florida. So I think it's trying to kind of get through that legal loophole.
Very strange. Does not seem like the most thought out scheme.
Strange and sad.
Well, folks, we will have to leave the conversation there for this week, but this would not be Rational Security if we did not leave you with some object lesson to think over until you hear from us again next week. Alan, what do you have for this week's object lesson?
My object lesson is basic in the most delicious way possible. It is Trader Joe's ice cream, specifically the salted maple ice cream, which is their special annual seasonal flavor. My God, is it good. My wife and I are eating it like one tiny teaspoon at a time, and it's wonderful. It's so, so, so tasty. Highly recommended.
Very seasonally appropriate. I like that. Quinta, what do you have for us this week?
I have another judicial opinion out of the great state of Texas. This is an opinion from a federal judge ruling in a Second Amendment case, finding that under Bruin, the Second Amendment protects an individual's right to purchase a semi-automatic firearm, even after indictment by a grand jury. What I want to talk about is not that what I think is objectively absurd finding, but a particular reference that the judge made in writing this opinion. The judge writes, "This court faces a predicament similar to Plato's allegory of the cave," and then goes on to describe the known knowns of the case, the known unknowns, and the unknown unknowns. So I personally, having, yes, for my sins, read Plato's Republic, did not recall this. And the reason, friends, is that that is not a line from Plato about known knowns and unknown unknowns. That is Donald Rumsfeld. And lest you think that maybe this judge was just like making like a weird joke or something, he says it again later in the opinion. He refers to, quote, Plato's unknown unknowns. So frankly, I don't know what happened here. Maybe it is a weird joke. Maybe the judge is genuinely confusing Plato and Donald Rumsfeld. I don't know if anyone in the course of human history has made that mistake before, but there's a first time for everything. So thank you, Texas judge, for this strange little moment of zen.
This is actually Quinta's known unknown about whether the judge knows that Donald Rumsfeld and Plato are not the same
people. Are different people.
It's Quinta's what is casting the shadow. I think we can figure this out, guys. I think we can tie this all back. Rummy went to Princeton. He read classics. I'm sure he dug in the Republic at some point. That's where this is all coming from. Just blame that first semester reading assignment. Anyway, for my object lesson this week, I am reporting back on my pepper adventures. As listeners may recall, earlier in the spring, actually, I noted that I planted several anonymous pepper plants, several of which remain anonymous because I can't figure out what some of these peppers are. But one of them, it turns out, is a Tabasco pepper plant, which I did not realize was actually a type of pepper. Tiny little red peppers, evidently popular throughout parts of the Southeast. And I have no idea what to do with these peppers. And I harvested a ton of them. And people sent me lots of wonderful hot sauce recommendations, which I greatly appreciate. But none of them really involved a type of pepper that seemed like these Tabasco peppers. And so I started Googling and I found something called Peppa sauce. P-E-P-P-A is usually the way it's translated, which evidently is a very popular, according to various places on the internet, hot sauce in parts of the American Southeast and South, primarily consisting of vinegar and peppers shoved into a bottle, and they just pour vinegar on top. And I ended up doing this, and I have to say, it's phenomenal. And I highly recommend people trying it. And so this is my first reported back hot sauce experiment success with this pepper sauce, where I essentially just jammed a bunch of these peppers, some garlic, some black peppercorns, poured some salt and sugar and hot vinegar over them and let them sit for a couple weeks. And for a couple week or two, like, nothing really happened. But now a few weeks in, I gotta say, it's gotten pretty good. Throw a little olive oil in there just to like mix it up a little bit. So I recommend this. I'll throw the recipe online. I recommend it to folks. If you've got a bunch of little tiny peppers you don't know what to do with, I bet you could do it with like bird's eyes and make it really spicy. My one beef with it is it's not spicy enough. I think if you really like adjusted certain types of peppers, you could really amp it up a couple notches. So I'm curious if people have any thoughts or experience in that regard they're willing to share. But for those who shared hot sauce recipes with me, stay tuned. I am harvesting them by the bushel load at this point, and hopefully I have time to try a few more in the coming weeks. So I will report back as I get through those different recipes. Until then, that unfortunately brings us to the end of this week's episode. Rational Security 2.0 is, like its forebear, a production of Lawfare. Follow us on Twitter at RETL Security, and be sure to leave a rating or review wherever you might be listening. While you're at it, visit lawfareblog.com for our show page with links and past episodes, for our written work and the written work of other Lawfare contributors, and for information on Lawfare's other podcast series, including our daily Lawfare podcast. And be sure to become a material supporter of Lawfare on Patreon for an ad-free version of this podcast and other special benefits. Our audio engineer and producer this week was Kara Schillen of Goat Rodeo, and our music, as always, was performed by Sophia Yan. We are once again edited by the wonderful Jen Patcha Howell. On behalf of my co-host Alan Quinta, I am Scott R. Anderson, and we will talk to you next week. Till then, goodbye.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.